This episode is sponsored in part by the Pastor Theologians Conference. Each October, the Center for Pastor Theologians hosts a one-of-a-kind interdenominational gathering of pastors and ministry leaders from across the U.S., exploring some of the most pressing issues facing the church in today's complex world. This year's conference is called Good Shepherds: Pastoral Identity and the Future of the Church. In our contemporary context, the pastorate can often be shaped by visions of leadership that sometimes overemphasize method and technique. We can find this, of course, in church growth strategies, in business-based leadership models, and in social media influencer culture. It's easy when navigating all the details to lose the plot, but October 20th to 22nd, you're invited to Chicago to renew your vision and commitment to following the way of the Good Shepherd. The Good Shepherds Conference will bring together a diverse group of pastors and ministry leaders to reflect together on how we can model pastoral ministry as under-shepherds of Jesus of Nazareth. Speakers include Kate Sonderegger, Matt O'Reilly, Doug Sweeney, Amy Peeler, and many more. Learn more and register at cptconference.com. That's cptconference.com.
The variety of spheres of the world's activity where Francis was considered a strong voice. Poverty, the environment, peace. Like, these are the big issues for humanity. And he uniquely, I think, was a respected voice in terms of all of those things. He also was able to inhabit the role of Bishop of Rome in a way that was attractive to many other Christians.
The Living Church. Serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878, welcome to the Living Church Podcast.
Welcome back, podcast listeners, and welcome to a bonus episode of the Living Church Podcast. We'll return to our regular program, an interview with Mary Berry of the Windlebury Center next Thursday as scheduled, but in the meantime, with the death of Pope Francis, we thought it would be a shame not to offer some sort of reflection on his ministry, particularly as it relates to Christian unity. Today, Father Matthew Olver and I will chat with Father Martin Brown, who serves at the Vatican's Dicastery for Promoting Christian Unity, and who was a key friend in Nishota House Theological Seminary's pilgrimage to Rome this year. Martin shares his first impressions of the Pope, his personality, and what it was like working for him. We discuss the Pope's choices, his charisms, his passion for shared leadership with other Christians, his inability and refusal to fit into a political box, and the fruit this has borne so far in personal relationships and the global scene, as well as some of the hype, frustration, and bewilderment in the wake of Francis' leadership style and its very public preference for the poor. We'll also chat a bit about, because we couldn't resist, the movie Conclave, and what it might get wrong and right about how the new pope will be selected. Father Martin Brown, OSB, is a Benedictine monk of Glenstall Abbey in Ireland. He currently lives at the Primatial Abbey of St. Anselmo in Rome and serves as an official in the Western section of the Vatican's Dicastery for Promoting Christian Unity. In the Dicastery, he is the desk officer for relations with the Anglican Communion and the World Methodist Council. He's also responsible, in collaboration with the Faith and Order Commission of the World Council of Churches, for the preparation of the prayers and reflections for the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity. He serves as the Catholic co-secretary of the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission and the International Anglican Roman Catholic Commission for Unity and Mission. And just a brief note on when we recorded this. It was just after Pope Francis' death and before his funeral. So take any details or speculations about the funeral proceedings with a grain of salt. I want to mention, finally, my own pilgrimage to Rome in 2022. We did a podcast episode about it. The whole episode was recorded on site in the Eternal City. It's an episode that's very dear to my heart because in it, I tried to communicate something of my own surprise at discovering why Rome and the ministry of its bishop are so important to the Christian family. Perfectly honestly, I came to Rome and to the ministry of Rome as a skeptic. After 2 hours in that city, my mind was totally changed. I'll include a link to that episode in the show notes. Now, whatever part of God's family you're coming from, you might stop to say a prayer for the repose of his servant Francis, or for all those cardinals meeting together to choose the new pope. And when you're done, we hope you enjoy the conversation. Father Martin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Nice to be with you.
It's so great to have you here, Martin. We were, I guess, email buddies for a long time before we actually met in person. And we spent a good deal of time together in this past January in Rome when I was there with Christopher Wells. We were doing our regular course on Anglican ecclesiology and ecumenism. You've been all over the internet and the television in the past couple of days talking to people about all sorts of questions around the death of Pope Francis and all of this transition. And the fact that you made time less than 48 hours after we asked you is enormous. So thank you. Thank you. It's very kind of you.
My pleasure. Glad to be able to help.
I thought we might begin. Maybe you could describe the first time you met Pope Francis and what your impressions were.
I certainly remember it very well. It was just before I started working in Rome in the summer of 2022. The autumn, in fact. And a few months previously, I was visiting Rome to be looked over. And as it happens, the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, ARCIC, was meeting in Rome that particular year. So my sort of interview visit was the same week that they were in Rome. And they had a meeting with Pope Francis at the end of their time. I was allowed to attend the audience as well. So it was rather exciting. It's funny, I don't normally do sort of fanboy excitement about meeting famous people, even almost a bit cynical about some of these things. But when it came to it, going to meet the Pope was a very, very big deal, even though I was sort of hanging on the coattails of a group who had business with him. I was near the end, and my predecessor in this role was sort of whispering into his ear who I was and why I was there. And I didn't speak any Italian at the time, but I'd kind of worked out a few things. So I managed to say to him that my mother, she lives on her own and is getting older and frail. And so I kind of just said, will you say a prayer for my mother? She's a little bit old and not very well. I had bought a rosary beads. I asked him, would he bless for her? That was it. Would he bless the rosary that I had bought for my mother? And so he did. But then he kind of turned around and he called to one of his assistants and said, the rosaries they give to most people are in a little kind of cheap plastic pouch, but they have some nicer presentation box ones, red ones for gentlemen and white ones for ladies. So he just called for Bianco. And so an assistant came over and gave him one of the white presentation boxes. And he said, give that to your mother.
Oh.
So I came out of the audience and texted my mother and said, the Pope sent you a rosary. She's not of the generation that would say things like, yeah, right. But she said whatever, words to that effect of kind of, yes, you're joking. And I said, no, he actually sent you a rosary. I'll call you later and explain. So she was thrilled, obviously. And when the meeting was over, I went back to my monastery. So it was a while before I got to visit my mother in person, another month or so. And the situation about whether I was going to be confirmed as the choice of this job was sort of dragging on. So it was all getting a little bit frustrating and tense. So I eventually got to visit my mother, gave her the beads. She prayed with it. And the next day I got news that the appointment was confirmed. So I have every reason to have a very warm memory of my first encounter with Pope Francis.
This just seems to confirm all that I've heard about Pope Francis and seen in his ministry as a real genuineness, a warmth, a real constant attentiveness to and favor toward people who are elderly or vulnerable, just always attention to the vulnerable and trying to put them first. I mean, is this something that also struck you on first meeting him? I mean, it just all seems so genuine.
Very clearly. Pope Francis obviously had a rather important job and a lot on his plate. And his resting face is quite serious and can be a bit, often looked a bit glum.
We call it resting Pope face over here at the...
Well, resting Pope face is quite severe and often a bit cross-looking. But when you meet him, or when you met him one-to-one, I don't mean just a private meeting, but if you just happened to be the person who was in front of him as he went through the crowd at a Wednesday audience, for instance, while he was looking at you, his face would light up. He personally was energized by interaction with people, but also, despite the fact that he was meeting thousands of people every week, like literally, all of whom, of course, wanted a piece of him. But even then, when he was quite diminished in terms of his strength, his capacity to welcome people... I've heard numerous people over the last few days talking about their encounters with him and all saying more or less the same thing, that it was only a few seconds, but those few seconds mattered. But then the question of having a particular interest in people who were marginalized in any kind of way. So yes, he spoke regularly about the elderly and care for grandparents. His own grandmother was a huge influence in his own life growing up. But there are all kinds of people who experience marginalization, whether that's people who are materially poor, homeless. We've seen the welcome that he gave to people who were on the margins of the church for various reasons, often to do with their lifestyle or with the circumstances of their life. He instituted the World Day of the Poor, a particular Sunday in the calendar, and each of the last number of years on that day, he would host a huge lunch in the big audience hall for hundreds, if not thousands, of homeless people and other poor people from Rome, including people that not everybody would approve of being invited to dine at the Pope's table, sex workers, people with serious criminal and psychiatric issues. We saw how he chose from the very start on Maundy Thursday each year, rather than do the big solemn liturgy in St. Peter's that evening or in the Lateran Basilica, I think the popes used to do on Holy Thursday. They would do the Chrism Mass in St. Peter's in the morning. But he didn't do a big public liturgy like that. Every year he went to a prison or a hospital or a remand centre for young people, a reformatory, and washed the feet of not always the model prisoners either, and not even always Christians. He caused a bit of upset in the very first year where he not only washed the feet of women, he washed the feet of Muslims in a jail. Like there's a lot of categories there that made people uncomfortable. But that is the pastor and parish priest that he was and that he tried to remain all his life.
Yeah. I'm just, your description of his genuine smile, this makes me think of the Secretary General of the Anglican Communion, Anthony Pogo's words about St. Francis recently, that he, quote, brought to the Petrine ministry the joy of the gospel. So the gospel, the gospel mandate to the poor, but also the joy of that. I just think that's remarkable.
Yeah, I think that's a wise assessment by Bishop Pogo. Doesn't surprise me. I think he's a very wise man. But yes, there's something infectious about that. And I think, I don't know, I think some people are More stuffy church folk might be a little bit surprised at the extent of the tributes, at the extent of the crowds that are in Rome at the moment, because Francis didn't always make it easy for his colleagues at the top levels of the church's administration. Mm. Whereas, in fact, I find headings and slogans like the People's Pope a little bit trite, but there are a lot of people in Rome at the moment. The opening hours of the Basilica for paying respects to his remains, people queuing for hours and hours and hours. Standing 4 or 5 hours in a queue in the sun, you wouldn't do that for just anybody. And you wouldn't, I don't think you'd do it out of curiosity either, because you can look at it on the internet. The respect is genuine, and the wanting to be close to him now one last time before he's buried, I think is real. And there's a real popular and natural and unaffected desire on the part of people generally to salute him in some way.
Yeah. I'm interested, given your role in the dicastery, how you think his ministry, how he's had a particular ministry of building bridges with non-Catholic Christians and specifically with Anglicans.
Pope Francis has been to sort of professional ecumenists, if you want to call people who work in an office like this, could sometimes be frustrating, because I think he didn't always have a huge amount of interest in the work of the theological dialogues. He would often, when he would bring ecumenical groups, quote something that he claims was once said by Metropolitan John Zizoulas, that basically, I know when Christian unity would happen, the day after Judgment Day. Which, of course, is probably true, but that doesn't mean that one doesn't try to work towards it now. So I think what he was getting at is that, yes, the theological stuff is slow. But what was more important to him was the visible, the practical. And so we saw, like actually both of his immediate predecessors, and probably many before them too, Francis was quite a master of the sign and of doing something relatively small, but that spoke volumes. So, for instance, one of the groups that is serviced jointly by our office and by the Anglican Communion Office in London is a thing called IARCUM, the International Anglican Roman Catholic Commission for Unity and Mission. And it's basically an attempt to to practically foster visible expressions of the kind of unity that has been explored and discussed and discovered to a certain extent through the work of ARCHIC, the Theological Commission. And most recently, it has been focused on bringing pairs of bishops together. And there have been two very significant pilgrimage experiences, mm-hmm. one in 2016. They started in Canterbury and finished in Rome that time. And one just in January 2024, where we started in Rome and finished in Canterbury. On both occasions, Pope Francis and Archbishop Justin Welby jointly commissioned the pairs of bishops to go forth and be ecumenical, basically. We are now sending you out to be bishops together. That doesn't solve many of the theological questions that ARCHIC is worrying about, but it's really powerful. We had this commissioning during the Vespers and the Feast of St. Paul at the Basilica of St. Paul, which is the main event in Rome for the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity. Mm. It's always presided over by the Pope. It was during the context of Vespers, so there's a homily by the Pope, which he reads, and it's already been translated into several languages and handed out to the journalists, and it goes on the website, and it's all very formal. As he was kind of getting ready to deliver his homily, he leaned over to the then secretary of our dicastery, Bishop Brian Farrell, and pointed over at Archbishop Welby and said, "Tell him he's on next." So Archbishop Justin had the duration of the Pope's homily to work out what to say. And he just stood up and they put a microphone in front of him and he preached. Was absolutely magnificent. Mm. But in fact, even if it hadn't been, it would have been amazing because he was preaching in a papal liturgy and that doesn't happen. And the Pope kind of joked afterwards to him and said, "I didn't tell anybody so they wouldn't stop me. If he'd sort of announced this as a plan, somebody might have tried to talk him out of it." So he just went ahead and did it.
I love it.
So yes, so that's, it's kind of amusing from that level. But in terms of showing his recognition of Archbishop Justin's ministry, of his seniority in the church, of him as a brother, they were seated in similar sized chairs. And this may seem a small thing, but in Rome, again, that's a significant thing. Hmm. Famously, both the Pope and the Archbishop had a particular interest in the peace process in South Sudan. And the first major thing they did together was an actual retreat in Casa Santa Marta, where the Pope lived, for the political leaders. And I think basically Archbishop Justin did more or less led the retreat, and the Pope sort of hosted it and participated in certain ways. And at the end, then very powerfully addressed the political leaders and then literally went down on his knees and kissed the feet of each one of them to kind of tell them how deeply he was imploring them to get their act together. Now, it hasn't entirely worked, but there have been major steps. Then there was a great plan that they would go on a joint pilgrimage, the Pope, the Archbishop, and the moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland. They went together and they led an ecumenical service together. They addressed the politicians together. They did something separately in sort of almost like caucus groups by denomination. It was very clear, too, that this was not a papal visit to which the other two leaders were invited to come along for the ride. This was an ecumenical pilgrimage. So in terms of commitment to Christian unity and to demonstrating it in a very visible way, he clearly had a very warm relationship with the ecumenical patriarch of Constantinople. From his time as a bishop in South America, he knew the Pentecostal world quite well. Mm. He had an ease and a connection with particular forms of evangelical and charismatic Christianity that certainly I don't think his predecessors would have had. His sense of the church and of the variety of gifts in the church, I think, was significant.
You spoke about two things there that I've been thinking about a lot, and other commentators have as well, and that is his use of the symbol. And actually, we published a piece today from Fritz Bauerschmidt, the Catholic theologian, on Pope Francis. And this is part of how he focused the article, was about his use of the symbol, but also his preference for the practical and the pastoral, as opposed to the technical theological. And that's, I think, in significant contrast to his predecessor, who was, I mean, one of the great theologians of the 20th century, probably. I wrote a piece about the controversial declaration that came out of the Dicastery for Doctrine of the Faith, Fiducia Supplicans, which gave Catholic priests permission to offer pastoral blessings to people in same-sex relationships. And I wonder if you might situate that striking moment within the pontificate of Pope Francis, because I don't think it actually is an outlier. It seems to me emblematic of the complexity of how he engaged his role.
Yeah, I think it's not an outlier. I think you're correct in that. And this has been one of the great frustrations for a lot of people, whether they are of a more conservative or a more progressive disposition, because the Pope regularly did things that one or other side would find really, this is great, he's one of us. And then sometime later would do something that seemed to make him sound like he's on the other side completely. And so he would often make what some people chose to interpret as very progressive noises, and then they say, but then he didn't deliver because he didn't actually change doctrine, or he didn't do whatever, didn't deliver on whatever they were looking for. Whereas in fact, if you listen to him, he always upheld doctrine, but he just tried to make space within it. And whether that's peculiar to him, whether it's part of his makeup as a South American, whether it's part of his spiritual makeup as a Jesuit who's very focused on discernment. But those sort of categories of conservative or progressive or liberal or just did not apply and lead to great frustration when people tried to apply them. Because getting back to where we were a minute ago, for Pope Francis, the pastoral was what drove him. And if he was opening up space somewhere, it wasn't because he was denying doctrine, or trying to throw away tradition. He was trying to find some way of making space. And that's very difficult and didn't always work, I'd say. And history will have to reflect on it a bit, because it can raise expectations and then cause disappointment. Trying to include as many people and make mm-hmm. nobody feel like they didn't have a place. That's a very hard thing to do. It's very hard to be that radically inclusive and uphold the integral teaching of the church and not sound really confused. The fact was, he was trying to change our way of being the church, our way of living as the church, the way we do our business, the way we proceed, to use kind of Jesuit language. And that for him was much more important than having big debates about the ordination of women to the diaconate or some of the other things that were considered really hot button issues. So that ambiguity, which some people found confusing or frustrating, I think that's part of the understanding of Pope Francis that we have to engage in. And I think it will take many years, actually, because it's not straightforward. And he felt that tension. There had been a question about the ordination of what are called viri probati, so married men of proven virtue and wisdom in local communities and places where there are very few priests, yes. The possibility of ordaining married men. And obviously this isn't a huge doctrinal issue. There are married men in the church already, but it would obviously be a major change in discipline. And if you allow it, could you allow it in one part of the world and not allow it in other parts of the world? So it still becomes a complicated issue, even though it's not a sort of a cornerstone of the deposit of the faith or anything like that. And some people did actually say to the Pope afterwards, we're close to him, why didn't you just do it? There was support for it. There's no theological reason not to do it. And he said, well, the time wasn't right. He didn't want to create further division in the church. So he didn't feel it was that the discussion had reached a mature point. And I think that's significant too, because he was fully aware of how difficult it can be to hold things together when you're trying to make space, but not tear asunder. And again, that led to huge frustration in some quarters, but I certainly would thank him for not doing something that caused huge division in the church. So
it would just make your job harder.
Well, indeed, or guarantee me a few more years in the job. Yeah. So yeah, that ambiguity bears a lot of interrogation, I think, as we reflect in the coming months and years.
Yeah, I mean, I think unlike his predecessor, I mean, I can think of times when reading the National Catholic Reporter and something like First Things, you know, in this country, both saying, see, he's our guy, or writing things about just how disappointed they were. And in fact, I think both publications this week wrote pieces about how disappointed they were that he didn't come through on X or Y. And I think that's striking. I mean, those are pretty emblematic of far ends of the spectrum, the Catholic world, at least in the United States.
Well, I know the secular media is doing that as well. I mean, I heard on NPR, I sometimes find how NPR reports on religion almost kind of quaint. And I just think you guys really need to hire more pious Christians to do your religion reporting, because sometimes you just need people to understand it from the inside to be able to do this. But they were the report on his legacy. It was a very brief thumbnail, you know, report. They were describing him as a very progressive pope, the pope of the people. And then they named three or four issues on which he was progressive in their, you know, in their view. The more inclusion of LGBTQ people, trying to reach out to the poor and immigrants. And then they said, but then that was balanced out. They used the word balance, but then that was balanced by his immovability on issues like abortion. And I just thought, you know, that's really interesting. And I think that this leadership style, making discernment such a big piece, is really, that's modeling something for Christian leaders. I think that Pope Francis was modeling a risk that's really worth taking. And maybe we should take note of this, the risk of being misunderstood or looking fickle or building false expectations, because you are doing the hard work of discernment in which there will be very few people who will wholly understand what you're doing, because there's not a party line that you're towing in any direction or another. You're trying to follow Jesus Christ and to interpret his word for the moment in which you are leading. So I find that risk of being misunderstood on all sides a scary one for a lot of Christian leaders, but I think a risk worth taking.
Yeah, and you're right. The amount of caricatures that I have read online at either extreme, but also even in the middle, I'm even conscious of myself not wanting to over-romanticize anything and just sort of sit here being all sweetness and light. Because yeah, that stuff we've just been talking about is complicated and is stressful and causes frustration. But the amount of arrant nonsense I have read about how amazingly inclusive and how progressive, and of course, progressive is, again, another deeply slippery word, because it can mean the person who thinks like I do, and anybody who doesn't agree with all my causes is therefore a hidebound conservative. And then the presumptions that the people would sometimes make, that because he was open to greater inclusion, for instance, of LGBTQ people, this meant then that he had somehow bought the entire liberal agenda and was going to be promoting abortion next week. Like, the idea is just absurd, deeply absurd. But people thought that. And then some people were horrified that he sometimes said not only conservative things, but very unfashionable things around pro-life issues. Or the fact that he linked pro-life issues to the death penalty, I know has been a particular strain to a certain kind of Christian in your part of the world in particular, less so than mine.
And to environmentalism as well.
Yeah, the idea that caring for the earth and not wanting to kill people is a sign of slippery liberalism is kind of scary. So people projected all kinds of things onto, and they do that on all leaders, I think, anyway. But Francis, because of his determination not to be boxed in by other people's projections, ends up getting stuff projected onto him from every corner, and you certainly need to consume your commentary with lots of health warnings.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. Hey, everybody. I'd love to tell you about our next Living Church conference that you don't want to miss. It's in St. Louis in November, and it's called Awe and Presence, a conference on worship and the arts. What do worship, going to church, or the beauty of the Christian liturgy have to do with real life? You can explore with us through art, literature, music, and history how sacraments and sacred rhythms usher us into the awe and presence of the one who is good, true, and beautiful, and forms our lives to his. Speakers include Malcolm Geit, W. David O. Taylor, Abram Van Engen, Grace Hammond, and Matthew Ulver on poetry, prayer, the body in worship, what it means to worship with the church of the past, and understanding the story we're in. Go to livingchurch.org/events for more info and to register, or click the link in the show notes today. And if you register now, you can get a 15% off early bird special. That's livingchurch.org/events, or click the link in the show notes. Well, I think we were also curious about what next.
Yeah. When we had dinner in Rome in January, we talked about the movie Conclave, which is probably likely to make another extra $100 million in the next month, given the timing. We talked about different parts of the movie that annoyed us. I told you I was annoyed with the inaccuracies of the vestments and and the bizarre scene of the cardinals all wearing these chasubles that no one in Rome would ever wear in this low-ceiling room.
Wow, can I just point out right now, no one has mentioned the brilliance of Ralph Fiennes acting. What we notice at the Living Church is how inaccurate the chasubles are.
I loved Ralph Fiennes and Stanley Tucci and everyone. I mean, it was a beautiful movie. It was filmed beautifully. It really made me think I should have a side job as being a consultant for movies so
no
that they
kidding.
Get things correctly.
Whatever about the chasubles, it would have been very useful if they actually had an altar for the mass they were celebrating. The mass for the opening of the conclave was a seminar room.
It was so strange. You know, I think one of the many pieces of the process that's confusing is, of course, the conclave itself. Americans, maybe in particular, are probably intrigued with the fact that this is an election. And so you might sort of conclude, oh, well, the election of the Pope is democratic. So I wonder if you might explore this a little bit. So the ways in which the election of a Pope might be rightly described as democratic, or how is it wrong to be democratic? And then to help us think about what kind of process the cardinals are going through right now, and how even certain cardinals emerge as frontrunners, of papabile, as they're sometimes called.
Well, the Pope is elected. I don't think that means that it's democratic, because apart from the fact that it's a very limited number of people who have the franchise to vote, also they're demographically interesting. They're all men. Most of them are elderly. Hmm. And they're all appointed by the person they're electing the successor to, or one of his predecessors. Yes, it's elected. This does not mean it's democratic. I think most people should pretty much appreciate that at this point. It's very hard to know how these things work. I read more books and newspaper articles telling us definitively what happened at the last couple of conclaves as if anybody actually knows. It is a process of discernment. And that's why they started what are called the general congregations the day after he died. He died on Easter Monday, and even though only a third or even less of the cardinals were in Rome by 9 o'clock the following morning, they had the first congregation. Now, some of that was because they had to do some practical work. They had to decide when the funeral would be and so on. But when they begin to move on a bit further from the practical things, they have a meditation by an outside religious, actually a Benedictine abbot is going to give them a conference, I think, on Monday morning. So it's a process of discernment. It's also a process of getting to know you. It's a bigger number of cardinals than ever before. Francis not only created lots more cardinals, but he created cardinals from places where there aren't very many Catholics in some cases. He wanted to recognize the peripheries. He also didn't have many meetings of the College of Cardinals. So a lot of them don't actually know one another. So it is good that they actually spend time to actually learn about one another as opposed to relying on what the social media is feeding them. They haven't announced yet what the first day of the conclave will be. It can't be until after the ninth day. The funeral is day one, then there's 9 days of official mourning. It can't be until after that 9 days. It doesn't have to be the 10th day either. So they have some flexibility as to when they decide to actually start. And they're not all there yet. Some of them are still en route. There's all of that. But they need time to listen to one another. We saw in the film all kinds of politicking. It would be naive to suggest that there's no politicking. I found a lot of the stuff in the film quite implausible. But again, it depends how you describe it. If you say politicking and conspiring, it sounds like a wicked, evil plot to do something nefarious. Whereas if it's trying to persuade and convince and suggest and promote particular candidates because they're considered to have the gifts. So one man's politicking is another man's information sharing and suggesting. And so they have to have the freedom. And like all that romance and drama around being locked in and so on and being kept sequestered, I think originally it started out as being a way of a very slow conclave, a very slow papal election at some point in the Middle Ages. The emperor locked them in to force them to make a decision. But in fact, the locking in now is not about forcing them to make a decision. It's about giving them as much freedom as is humanly possible to concentrate on the work at hand, to increase the chance of what happens reflecting the mind of the college under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. So it's a human gathering, but it's obviously clearly spiritual as well. And I think that was the other thing that I found a little bit implausible. I've seen it in other films too, where when the conclave is cast in the accounts or the acting or the novel or whatever as sort of factions, and it's never as simple as that.
Yeah,
it's possible to have cynical, power hungry people, even in the College of Cardinals. But you can also be sure that the vast majority are going to be fretting about what they're doing. They're going to be stressed and really, really relying on God and trying to really sense the Spirit's leading. They want to do the right thing. I know this from my own life as a Benedictine monk, where we elect an abbot. Now, it's obviously at a much smaller level, and the stakes are a lot lower on some levels. But people go into the room trying to do the right thing. Some come with ideas in their head. I haven't always had the same person in mind at the end as I had at the start. Not because somebody got to me and persuaded me or bribed me or any of those things you see in the films, but because during this process of listening and praying, one changed one's mind and did in the end what I thought was the best and right thing to do. And you can be sure, if our small little monastery, that we feel the burden of trying to do that correctly and wisely, well, the burden that the cardinals have to try and make a wise decision is immense.
Yeah,
it's hard to depict that in fiction or film. You can kind of show one person having deep existential and spiritual stress about it. It's very hard to portray a discerning assembly.
That is really interesting. And if there are any filmmakers out there, maybe try your hand at it and see if we can get a depiction of that. But I think, you know, what you've just described, Martin, and maybe even if people just go see Conclave too, I think what they could both inspire is a reminder to pray for these Amen. Guys as they themselves are praying and discerning, to pray for them. If you don't mind, I just have one more question for you,
sure.
Martin. From your perspective, I wonder what you think a key challenge is that confronts the church right now, or should I say confronts Christians right now, with the loss of Francis's leadership. Or maybe to put it another way, what are you praying for or hoping for God's people in the next 6 to 12 months?
Ooh, no pressure. It's interesting, again, reflecting on the last few days of the coverage, the variety of spheres of the world's activity where Francis was considered a strong voice. Poverty, the environment, peace, like these are the big issues for humanity. And he uniquely, I think, was a respected, not always heeded, but a respected voice in terms of all of those things. He was also, and this isn't just because it's what I do day in, day out, he also was able to inhabit the role of Bishop of Rome in a way that was attractive to many other Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And not just sort of crypto-papalist eccentrics. There's been a growing, I think, acceptance of the principle of the leadership of the Bishop of Rome for the whole of Christianity. And that is certainly has been happening anyway. And Pope John Paul II really got that moving, and Pope Benedict continued in the same way. But Pope Francis has lived it in a way that has been very significant. I traveled to the airport yesterday to collect the Archbishop of York, who was coming to represent the Church of England. And we went straight from the airport to St. Peter's to pay our respects to the Pope's remains. And we spoke about Francis as the primate of the Church. Archbishop Welby, now retired and largely quiet, wrote a piece for one of the English newspapers yesterday about the Pope Francis I knew, where again he spoke about how you could see Francis as primacy. You could see that Francis was leading the church. So clearly from the point of view of the thing that drives me and that I work for, to see that direction continued, to see the direction in terms of the synodal life of the church, mm-hmm. that we don't backtrack. There'll always be changes of emphasis and style, but I don't think any pope would backtrack. But it's important that continue in the life of the church, that the Bishop of Rome can manage to do those jobs as the leader of the Catholic Church, as a recognized leader among all Christians, while still having then a voice in civil society where he's respected in all kinds of other areas. Mm-hmm. That's a tall order. But this very feeble man who could hardly walk has occupied that space for the last number of years. And it's actually quite incredible. And again, only emphasizes the need to pray for the cardinals, because it is a very tall order and a pretty frightening job description.
Yeah. I mean, the ministry of credible public Christian witness is always a tall order and a frightening job description. We have been speaking today with the Reverend Martin Brown, OSB of the Vatican's Dicastery for Promoting Christian Unity. Father Martin, thank you so much for being with us at this very busy time for you.
It was my pleasure. I enjoyed it very much.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. As of April 2025, we don't have a paywall on any portion of this show, not even bonus episodes. So if you enjoyed this bonus episode, if you love what we do, you can support us by going to livingchurch.org and clicking donate, or click the link in the show notes today. You can also leave us a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, or share this episode with a friend. Until next time, our amazing, hardworking boss of a producer is Leslie Thompson. I'm Amber Noel, your host, and it's been good to be with you. Peace.